Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at oalaig.org, where you'll find links to prior podcasts from this meeting available in multiple formats. The opinions expressed on the Light a Candle podcast are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Leslie.
Put this here for you guys. Hi, everybody. I'm Leslie, compulsive overeater, bulimic.
Hi, Leslie.
Very grateful to be abstinent and in this room tonight, and so glad to see all of you. I feel awesome. I'm so happy there's a cat, there's a dog, there's a vet.
There's a vet.
Well, I don't know if you're a vet, but.
Oh, I am.
There you go. All my favorite things. Well, not some, well, the vet I'm very grateful for. Anyway, if you're new, I want to welcome you to Overeaters Anonymous and tell you that my life, like Francesca said, is completely, completely different. It was funny when you were talking about being grateful for your body. I'm a hairdresser. I've been cutting hair for 42 years. I have like arthritis in my fingers. They're like knobby. I don't really even care how they feel. I'm like, can you just make the knob things go away? But I always say, like, thank you so much for your service. Like, I've made a living off my hands, and I stand on my feet for, you know, 8, 10, 11 hours a day, and I am so grateful for my body, and I did not treat my body well for a long time, and I hated myself. Like, that's why when you say, like, I love my life. I wouldn't trade my life with anybody's. The good times, the bad times, like, without those lows, there wouldn't be no highs. And I don't believe God makes mistakes. And I don't believe God has ever given me any more than I could handle, even though there have been many times when I have called my sponsor and said, I'm not going to make it. And she's like, can you just do it for the next hour? You know, or let's just get through today. I mean, I have called many times and said, I'm not going to make it. Like, I can't do this. It's too much for me. But I am really grateful that I have a program today and I have fellows and that we're in this room. You know, I'm so happy to be in this room. I've been coming here since Light a Candle first started. I don't know what year that was that Roy started it, but I have come since the beginning. And I think if you're new, the biggest thing I can tell you is that you just keep coming back. Don't stop coming. Like, meeting makers make it, you know. There are all those little slogans, but I believe that to be true. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I grew up with literally every opportunity. You know, my parents were good parents. I grew up actually in Brentwood, like right here. I was born at St. John's Hospital. My dad's an engineer. He designed computers for Xerox. He's practical. He's logical. There's no big feelings in my house. There's no yelling. There's no screaming. There's Pat, you know, like, my dad's thing was anytime I told my dad I had a problem, he'd say, let's get that on a spreadsheet, you know, and then he wanted information. Like, my family, like, they want just facts and information, and I was a bit of a liar, so I just didn't want to give you all the information. And I have a brother. My brother Michael is very smart. He got an Apple computer when they first came out, and I don't think he came out of his bedroom. He was on, he was on this show called Art Linkletter, and to go on Art Linkletter, you had to be, Bobby knows it, you had to be really smart. It was kids say the darndest thing and things, and my brother was very witty, very funny. You could throw a Rubik's Cube at him. He could do it, like, blindfolded. He just, you'd give him any number. I'd be, like, you know, on my fingers, and he'd, like, he was like a calculator, you know. And so I just felt really inadequate in my family. And I look back now and think, I don't even know why. You know, it's just the way I'm kind of wired. And I was a gymnast when I was young, and I was a good gymnast, but it was so scary. I mean, I do look at gymnasts now, and I mean, the beam is like that big, you know. I was little, I was strong, but it was that feeling like I always felt like I wasn't good enough, or it's that, like, no matter where I am, I'm sure I should be somewhere else, you know, and happiness is just around the next corner, you know. And so I was doing gymnastics 6 days of the week. I had a horse. I was riding. And then I started smoking pot, you know, and then that was the end. I was in private school at Crossroads. And then once I got going, I mean, they put me in public school. I thought it was like heaven. I could sign my mother's name. That was back when you had to have a note with your mom's name. I could still sign my mom's name perfectly right now. And I just started ditching school and going to the beach and smoking pot and hitchhiking. We all hitchhiked. Like, have you seen any girl hitchhiking in a bathing suit recently? I mean, we hitchhiked up PCH, but we wouldn't get in a van, you know. It was a... my friends and I, we'd like suss it out, like a van with shag carpet and beanbags, or, you know, it was like back in the 70s. So anyway, but it was fun, you know. I mean, I started drinking, I started using, you know, and I was off and running. And what happened to me then, like, I was always thin, but we were always going on a diet. Like, there was a Vidal Sassoon diet. My best diet was just take a couple Cross Whites and don't eat at all, you know, and clean the house like a crazy person. And I took Black Beauties, Cross Whites, I smoked cigarettes, I drank a lot of coffee. I mean, I always thought to lose weight, you had to stop eating, like, completely. And I never knew that. I remember somebody I sponsored one time said to me, like, you deserve to have three nourishing meals because you live on this planet. And I'm like, oh, I thought I could just have like two, or like a part of one, or, you know, just eat one thing over and over and over forever. Like, I had all these cockamamie food ideas that had been formulated over years of reading magazines, reading Cosmopolitan, reading this diet. And so at that time I was, you know, fairly thin. I was never really that large. And, I ended up, you know, I mean, I'm in AA. I got sober in 1985. And right before I got sober, I was insane. I was really thin. I lived in West Hollywood. I hung out with all drag queens. I was dancing at a place called Probe, which opened at 2 a.m. after the Straight Rocker Club closed. And I was with all gay men. We all had instruments, tambourines, cabasas, castanets. I had like a little tambourine. And I was wearing these little clothes that they made me, the drag queens that matched their clothes. And I never ate. I mean, I smoked cigarettes, I drank pink drinks, the Cosmopolitans, and I did crystal meth and MDA and ethyl chloride and poppers and just a ton of drugs. And I do not remember ever marketing, putting food in my house, or having a meal. We went to Noggles and got grape juice after the club. Like, and I mean, we danced for like 3 days straight, you know. So when you dance for 3 days straight and you don't eat, you know, you're very thin and you're a little wiped out and a little paranoid. So I was like 22 years old, and I was cutting hair. That's the weirdest thing, too. I was like the artistic director of my salon. And we were all loaded at work, too, you know, drinking, snorting coke. I was dealing. And that's how I lived, you know. So when my grandfather got sober January 9th of 1952 in Louisville, Kentucky, not for the first time, but for the last time until he died, with 47 years of sobriety. So my grandfather did that thing, which the Big Book talks very clearly, and it's crosses right over into OA, is that, you know, the alcoholic can gain the trust of another instantly. That this program only works because we identify. Nobody told me what to do. My grandfather took me to Chinese food in Westwood, told me his story, and I knew because I heard the story. I had to go to an AA meeting even though I didn't want to. And I ended up not getting sober right then, but going back to Kentucky, getting on my knees in church with my grandmother and saying a prayer and asking God for help. And so I am absolutely positive that when you ask God for help and you surrender, when I surrendered and from the bottom of my heart wanted help, the help arrived. You know, I believe sometimes there is that window that opens up, and if you step through, you get it. Like, how come some people come in and get it and some people don't, you know? And I ended up getting sober June 19th, 1985. And I've been sober ever since that day. And that is miraculous. And so then what happened, I was sober, going to meetings, you know, the program changed my life. And then I always felt bad because I had gone to Vidal Sassoon when I was 18 because I didn't want to go to college. And kind of had to go to college in my family. But I became a hairdresser and, you know, it actually worked out perfectly. In hindsight, you look back at everything and God makes no mistakes. But and so I felt bad that I hadn't gone to school. So I went to SMC. I didn't even have my high school diploma. I had ditched my first period so many times. And it was so weird because they let me go through the ceremony. I have pictures of me graduating from Pali High, but I didn't graduate. So I took that one class, got that. And then what happened to me there was once I got sober, and I hear this over and over in Overeaters Anonymous, I could not stop eating. Like, I got sober, quit smoking, and then it was like game on, you know, and I knew where all the good food was at meetings. I knew which meetings had tons of candy and, you know, donuts and crap. And so I was started just eating and I was so obsessed with food. And I think that is the scariest thing about eating is that, like, I stopped drinking and I have not wanted to drink. I know why I drank, but I have not had the obsession to drink. You have to eat every day. Like, it is not easy. And so you know, my food was all over the place. And then I was at Clancy's Yard, actually, and the cool girls were talking about throwing up. And I was like, I'm going to do that, you know, and I did, you know. And so I started throwing up in sobriety. And school made me really want to throw up. No, I just hated being in school. Like, you can't get by like who you know or who you're dealing with or maybe who you sleep with or, you know, any of those things. Like, you had to do the work. And I had to always like figure out a way to get by. Like, I'm very, you know, creative and, you know, like I have good willpower, but I just hated school. I mean, I did what I learned here, which I never ditched school. I always went to class. I always sat in the front. I could never raise my hand. I was like terrified to raise my hand and ask a question. I had a hot tutor in statistics. I remember I loved my tutor so much. He was so good looking. And then I started throwing up. And so I would go to school. I worked Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. I went to school Tuesday, Thursday. And I would go home from school, close the blinds, turn on the TV, open that refrigerator, and just binge on, like, whatever. Throw up, binge, throw up. And then I would brush my teeth and go off to my AA meeting. And what it did for me, you know, I always think about, like, my husband always goes, what is that people do? He is so confused. Why would you throw your food up? I'm like, it's a bulimic, Bob. Like, oh, there's laxative abusers, there's exercisers. He is so confused about any of it. Like, makes no sense to him. But it got rid of all the feelings I had inside of me. Like, I could feel bad, feel stupid, feel less than, feel inadequate, throw up, and I had no feelings. And then I was doing this, and then I went to New York one time, and I was in New York with my friend, Julia, and she would go to work, and I was, like, supposed to be going to do stuff in New York, and I remember I ate her ice cream, and then I threw up. She didn't have good plumbing in New York, and threw up a couple more times. And I was like, I better go buy another ice cream because I'm going to have to. And then I would try to eat it to the right point, and then I missed, and then I had to get, you know, it took my day, you know, and just stuff like that. I think, like, it kept me from living my life. Like, now I eat a meal, and I have 5 hours or so where I live my life and I'm not eating. There's no food entering my mouth. And then I eat my next meal and then I live my life. But it just was, it's such a horrible place to be, like, in the depths of compulsive eating. And bulimia is just, I mean, it's disgusting. You know, one time at Thanksgiving with a bunch of sober people, they wanted to know about it. And I'm like, I don't think you really want to know the whole deal, but it comes out in order, just so you know. So you know when you're at the right point, you know, and there are certain things you don't eat because they don't come up well, you know, and everybody was like, interesting. So, you know, and then I was living at my mom's at this time, and they had horrible plumbing, and so I would throw up. It would come up like in the flower bed. Like I knew all the restaurants that had bathrooms, like single stall. You could always tell if somebody had thrown up because there would be like lettuce floating in the toilet, you know, right? The bulimics, no. And so I decided that I should not throw up at my mom's in the toilet because of the plumbing, and so I would just throw up in a bag, tie it off, and put it in the closet, and then take it out in the morning. I mean, it's so repulsive. And so what ended up happening to me is that I had a sponsor. My sponsor saved my life. You know, I always followed my sponsor's direction. I was always a good sponsee. And I knew how the 12 steps worked, and I knew that they did work. And then one night, I'd been throwing up, and, you know, my eyes were all bleary. I was all weird and disconnected and separate and, in, you know. And I went to the meeting, and she looked at me and said, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Nothing. I'm fine." And then I remember exactly. I was driving on the 10, going through the tunnel onto PCH, and I was like, if I lie to my sponsor, what is the point? You can lie to your therapist. You can lie to yourself. You can lie to anybody you want. But, like, my sponsor is an objective person who wants nothing but the best for me. And I was like, if I tell her, I'm going to have to stop. And so I told her, and I was like, I don't want to stop. I don't want to gain weight. It gave me a sense of control, which is so not true. I mean, lack of power is my dilemma. I have no control over my body, but all the weird things I did, like weigh myself every Monday, write it in my little square, my day runner, my day timer, whatever those things were called. And if it was high, I felt crappy and I ate. If it was low, I rejoiced and ate, you know, like, I mean, I would try to eat the same thing over and over and over every single day. And so I told her, and she told me, it's actually so funny, she told me to call Sia, and who I don't even think was in OA, but I called this other woman, and she sent me to an anorexic, bulimic body image meeting, like in Brentwood, right down the street at somebody's house. And I went, and I felt such a relief when I went to that meeting. I knew that the girls there, especially anorexics, bulimics, because that's my game, understood me. And I was told to just keep coming back. Just keep coming back and you will eventually stop throwing up. And I kept coming back. It's so funny, I ran into my friend EG last night at Breathwork, and I met her I started going to the Drug and Alcohol Center. It was on Santa Monica Boulevard. I went to a bulimic anorexic meeting Monday night at 8:45. It was so late, like, I'm asleep by 9:30 now, 9:30 or 10. And we went there, we were all crazy, and I kept coming back. I threw up a bunch more times. This is what Venora and I were talking about, and eventually, I like, my thing is that no matter what I put in my body, it has to stay there. Doesn't matter what it is, it's staying in. And on Thanksgiving of 1987, I went to somebody in AA's house for a Thanksgiving thing. I wasn't going to go. I think my parents were out. My parents all had timeshares over Thanksgiving. So I really had no, like, where should I be at Thanksgiving? And so I was like, I'm just going to stay home, which meant I was just going to eat and throw up. And feel bad about myself. And so I went with a girl I sponsored in AA who was in OA, and we went to this party and we went to the bathroom and we got on our knees and we asked God to help us eat one plate of abstinent food. And then we went out, we got our one plate. We ate our plate of food. I think we went back in the bathroom, got on our knees and thanked God for our abstinent meal and asked God to help us not eat until our next meal. And then throw up. And I went off to the meeting that night, and that, so my abstinence date is Thanksgiving, which is actually November 26th of 1987, and I haven't thrown up since that day. My food was a whole other story. It was kind of, I did not have perfect food, but what happened to me is once I started to work with other people, my life changed. You know, and the book talks about that, you know, one alcoholic can help another. And, like, it's something you shouldn't miss. It's a bright spot in our lives. And so I started to sponsor all these girls. And I was like, why do they even want me to sponsor them? Like, and I hear this so much from people that, like, I'm not doing it right, or my food's not great, or I'm like, who has perfect food? I don't even know what that is. You know, I stole the How food plan one time because it was at the literature table by accident at some meeting, and I was like, I'm going to do the How food plan so I'll get really skinny. And I looked at it and thought, I don't think I could actually do this. And and anyway, so it took me a long time to figure out what to eat, what not to eat, what works for me, how long to go between meals. One time I made a Caesar salad for something, and I bought a bag of croutons, something I would then never do again because I think I ate the whole bag, and felt sick, and just, I mean, there was a lot of trial and error there. But, and I learned a lot of great things. Like, a lot of time I would eat my meal and then I would call somebody. We didn't have cell phones back then. And I would say, I just want to commit that I'm done with my meal. I can say it to anybody. I could say it to literally like a stranger on the street. I'm just committing, I'm done with my meal. And I've done it where I've leaving my AA meeting, and I'll say to another OA person, girl, somebody, like, I'm not going to eat anything after the meeting. And once I say it, I do it. Or I'll call you, you know, and sometimes I would walk down the street and think, I'm going to pretend that I'm really happy in my body and that I like the weight that I am right now. Because I think what happens is, like, to me, OA and the 12 steps and the spiritual experience is about living a day at a time and being totally present in this moment, because life is happening right now. And I spent so much time, well, in my head, in my thighs, you know, I'd get trapped in my closet trying on my skinny jeans, or I stopped weighing myself in the very beginning. I don't weigh myself. I didn't have a scale forever. My husband brought home a scale at one point, and I don't step on that scale. I do it if I have to, like before surgery, stuff like that. I've had to do it. But even like we've had to weigh the cats, you know, because I've had some sick cats, some cats die, some cats with different, you know, things. And my husband's like, well, just weigh the, get on the scale. I'm like, I'm not getting on the scale. You get on the scale. I'm going to hand you the cat. You're going to weigh the cat. You know, like, I'm not getting on the scale. And it doesn't work for me. It makes me feel, I think about it too much. So I stopped doing that, you know, and I started going through the steps, and I had a couple different sponsors, and then I actually worked with my friend E.G. quite a bit. And my life, you know, got better and better. I ended up, you know, getting married to my first husband, got pregnant, had a baby, then learned that my body can do things that, who knew, right? Like, and my body is not mine to manipulate. I felt good about myself, you know, and I ate healthy food, and it's amazing having a baby, right? Like, it is an amazing thing that your body can do that. And, you know, then I got divorced and it was horrible, and it was the most pain I had ever felt. I didn't think that I would get divorced when my daughter was one, and it happened. And, you know, I look back now, I get along great with my ex-husband. He's still sober. We're both sober in 85. And my daughter they bought a house not long ago, maybe a year and a half ago, 5 minutes away from him. And it's great. You know, she used to always say, why can't you fight like normal divorce people, you know? And because I believe, well, we're both sober, and I'm abstinent and sober, and I'm working a program, and that resentment is the number one offender, and it does cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit. And so I made a decision to not be mad, you know, and Andrea, we're just talking about reading that Just for Today, and that, you know, just for today, I'll, you know, make up my mind to be as happy as Abraham Lincoln said, you know, we can be as happy as we make up our mind to be. And that totally worked. I also started running marathons, and, you know, I'm very compulsive. So I ran with a bunch of sober people, and I didn't think I could ever run a marathon. I didn't really like running, but I had a jogging stroller and no babysitter. So there I went, and I ran a 5K, a 10K, and then I went to Vegas. And it was so weird. When I was running that marathon, I was with a girl that I sponsored, Linda, and she was a great runner. And we had trained. We had taken action. It's kind of what we learn here. Like, I took actions I didn't believe in. I didn't believe they would work, but I followed a plan and took the next indicated step. And then here we were in Vegas running the marathon, and at like 20 miles, I started crying, and I was like, I'm running a marathon. And we were running fast because I'm really competitive. And it was the weirdest thing. I finished that marathon, and I felt like I left all my pain and my troubles on the road. And I came out of it feeling better. And then I'm so obsessive that I ran another marathon a month later in LA, and it didn't go so well. It was too fast. But I did it, and then, you know, we kept running, and it was really, really fun, and it gave me something to do and people to be with. And that passed, you know, because I used to think, like, this pain is not going to pass. I've since had way worse things happen to me. You know, in 2010, I was diagnosed with a really rare kind of cancer called ocular melanoma. I was in Hawaii. I didn't wear glasses. I had had LASIK. I had amazing vision. I hadn't been to the eye doctor in probably like 12 years. And I realized, like, I couldn't see, and my eye was bothering me, and squinting, and it was so weird. And then, of course, I looked it up because, as I tell my husband, I'm like a doctor, you know, and he's like, you're not my doctor, and let me prescribe for you. And so I really couldn't figure it out online. And so when I did call, I had an eye doctor that I'd seen for an emergency one time, and when I called there, they were like, you need to come in right away. You know, my vision was literally deteriorating day by day. It was like looking through, like if you look through the peephole on your door and it's beveled because I have a tumor in my eye that was pushing against my optic nerve and my macula. And so, boy, it started a thing that, man, when you end up in the cancer world, there is no escaping. You know, I went from there to Jewel Stein. I got a surgeon. I had a scheduled surgery date. I got a PET scan, a CT scan, you know, an oncologist, a radiologist, and it was terrifying, you know, and it's so funny, I never thought, like, they sewed this plaque full of radiation in my eye for 1 week, and during that time, I had to sign a waiver that I would not, yeah, be around children or small children or animals, because I was radioactive, and oh my God, my family made so much fun of my radioactive self. And my husband made a video, and they were calling me Helen Keller. I'm like, she had other problems besides blindness, you know. And it was great. It was great, though. Like, in looking back now, I think, you know, my friend always said to me, John would say that which I cannot laugh at, that which I can laugh at cannot harm me. And so we laughed so hard, even though it was horrible. And I never worried about how I would look. That's what's so funny. And man, if you can see, you should appreciate your vision, because they took that thing out. I remember they're like, great. And I'm like, okay, I can't see anything. Like, I had a gas bubble in my eye, so my retina didn't detach. I was so off balance. And like, when you can see with two eyes, you have depth perception. When you only have one eye, you have no depth perception. It was very disconcerting. But the thing that I had learned from that was that it slowed me down. It made me walk slowly, do everything slowly. I mean, I would bump into things. You know, I can't see anything peripherally, and I can't really see anymore now. They told me my vision would deteriorate over time. But at Jewel Stein, they're like, oh, people do fine with one good eye and one so-so eye. And that's their motto there. So I just had a good attitude, you know. I have a good attitude. It's my husband and I say it's a good thing it was me and not you. I can't even put an eye drop in his eye. And like, I've had shots in my eye, stitches in my eyes, like so many things. I can hold my eye open for almost anything. And you know what's so interesting is that like 435 days ago, I started writing two-way prayer. So my friend Quinn sent me this video of two-way prayer I watched the video with Father Bill W. It told you the history of AA and the Oxford group and how Bill and Bob wish they had put more prayer and meditation in the book and in the steps. And I mean, there is step 11. And it hit me at the right time. Like, I'm a big writer. I love writing. And so I started doing it. And I've done it every single morning for that long. And it has literally, like, changed my life. And I've done a way longer meditation. My meditation is upped, you know, from, like, torture. It's 3 minutes. It's 5 minutes. When is it over? Oh, my God. I can't stand it. And so now I do this thing in the morning and I feel like I can go out in the world. Like, all the fear of people, I used to go to work and be afraid. I'm like, what am I afraid of? Like, it's so weird. I don't have it anymore. Like, it's changed everything. And then I was at Jules Stein, and my surgeon, who is very brisk, and she doesn't even shake your hand. I mean, no, it's not warm, but she's brilliant. And she is kind of more involved in Eastern medicine now with cupping and gua sha and acupuncture. And she was like, let me look in your eye and see if you have a cataract and maybe we can fix that and it'll improve your vision somewhat. She's like, you don't really have a cataract. She goes, which is very strange. She goes, everybody who has radiation with oil therapy, which I had, and has a cataract. And she goes, I don't really know why you don't have it except of your lifestyle. She said, you have really good vascular health. And I'm like, I do work out. She knows I don't drink. She knows I'm sober. And I said, you know, I don't drink or smoke. And I, you know, I exercise and I eat well and I meditate. And I said, I write every morning. She goes, I mean, she was like laser. She goes, what do you write? I said, I said, it's an AA thing. I said, I write this thing called two-way prayer. I write a question to God and God writes me back. And she was so fascinated by the whole thing. But it was so interesting that she attributed that to my health, you know? And so I'm so grateful that I work a program, you know, that I take this, you know, I've had a lot of talk with people about working the program, working the steps, step work, 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 work. And I'm like, I don't know if you necessarily work it. You take the steps and then you practice the principles in your life, which to me means I get up in the morning, I make my bed, I get on my knees first thing and ask God for help. I answer my phone. I pray, meditate. I do a whole morning routine, which I truly enjoy. And even if you don't have one, I always tell the girls, you can do 5 minutes. You can write a gratitude list, read one of the readers. The OA book was really, really good today. I can't remember what it said, but it was actually very good today. And you can do 1 minute of meditation, you know, and then I go to work. I'm on time. I do what, like my sponsor, Marion, always told us to do these four things. One was to be on time. Two was to keep your commitments. Three was to act better than you feel. And four is to treat people with love and kindness, whether they deserve it or not. And all of those things make me successful because I am a success in my life. Like, I was a really good mother. My daughter has turned out, she's amazing. My daughter's smart. She's intuitive. She's successful. She's talented. She's a chef. She creates these lovely events, is a wonderful host. She's married. I mean, like, and that's all because when I was in it, it didn't seem like it was working. It felt too hard for me. But I look back now and think, God, I'm so glad I didn't quit before the miracle happened, you know? And same with myself. Like, my husband and I were just saying this morning that, like, we have a really great marriage. We've been together 20 years, and then my daughter eloped in 2018, and then in 2019, she had a big wedding. And she was like, we were engaged forever, and then she's like, you and Bob should get married. And so we wrote a post-it and put it in his closet and said, save the date, we're getting married on, you know, September 7th. 2019. And you know what? It was so fun. And I'm so glad we got married before the pandemic. And we really get along really, really well. And I have to say, I read this thing. Do we have that? I read this thing in the AA 12 and 12 the other day, actually with Fenora. And it's so funny. I was just telling my sponsor today, I said, how do they manage to put things in the book that I have never seen before? Because it says at the end of the foreword, it says that non-alcoholics can practice these 12 steps in their life. It's like the very last paragraph into the next paragraph, and it can work for them also. And I read it to my sponsor this morning. I'm like, I have never read that before. She goes, she's sober 47 years. She goes, I don't think I've ever read that before either. And I told my husband and he said, yeah. He said, will you be my sponsor? And I'm like, I would love to sponsor you. I'll give you direction right away. But he watches what I do. He hears what I say. And so did my daughter, you know? And I sponsor a lot of women in this room. I have sponsored a lot of women, and you know, I'm super proud of all of you, and all of you keep me on the beam. You keep me doing the deal. And I do believe that it's that, you know, link in the chain, that it flows into me, and that, you know, body of water can't be stagnant. It has to be clear. So it has to have an intake and an outtake. And so every day I ask, like, what can I do for the compulsive overeater who's still sick? Like, how can I best be of service? And I don't think God ever gives me more than I can handle. I'm not a believer in saying you're too full to sponsor. I've heard so many people say they asked somebody to sponsor them and they said, no, I'm full. I think you say yes, and it all somehow works itself out. You know, that's my experience, and I learned that in AA. And you know, I just think if somebody asks for help, you help them, and or at least find them help. So I am very grateful to be abstinent today. My meals are clean. I try to eat clean spiritual food, not diet, and the disease is quiet. But I have a daily reprieve based on my spiritual condition. Like, I was on the phone with Mallory one day. I was like, my pants are tight. I'm going to kill myself. Like, I mean, it can happen to me quickly, you know, and dealing with my body aging has been an interesting thing too. Like, it's not the body I had when I was younger, but I am forever grateful for what my body does for me. And so I try to nourish myself in a loving way and be kind to myself. So if you're new, keep coming back. OA does work. Get a sponsor and stay, you know, in the middle of the pack. And I think, I don't have much time, but if somebody has one question, we could take a question. But thank you for letting me share. Does anybody have a question?
Huh. You guys, like, four steps, I think it was like, be on time, keep committed, act more than feel. Now, what was the fourth one?
Act better than you feel.
Act better than you feel.
And then treat people with love and kindness, whether they deserve it or not. Yes.
Talk a little about your two-way prayer, please. Do you ask a different question every day?
Oh, yeah. Two-way prayer.
Yeah.
You can go to twowayprayer.com. You can just look it up because it is like a 40-minute video, and he's sober along for like 50-something years, Father Bill W. He's got a beautiful voice. And in my prayer at first, I mean, I have asked things like, should I get this cat from the Lang Foundation who has cancer and they want to forever foster? And God said, get the cat. You know, I mean, absolutely, you can do it. And I have Luigi now, and I am so happy. And he's quite healthy at the moment. And we're hoping he defies the 6 months to a year. He's already gone a year. So I've asked really specific things, you know, like that. And then what has happened over time is, I don't have a question, but what has evolved is that it's like one page in this book. I write in the same book with the same kind of pencil, and it's a conversation between me and God. And so I'll kind of ask something. It's not really specific, like the cat thing, but what God always says is, I am so proud of you. You're amazing. You've got this. You are a spiritual gangster. Like, go with me everywhere. I will carry you. I will walk with you. I will give you every answer you need. Like, I mean, it's just this. I read it sometime and think, I didn't write that. Like, I don't think about it. It's like automatic writing. But I enjoy writing quite a bit. I think it taps into your sixth sense. Different than when I'm talking. Because some of the stuff that comes back from God is not actually the way I would speak to you now, but I can write it, and then I reread it, and I'm like, wow, like, I have a higher power of my own. And I do believe that is what the 12 steps are about. It's finding a spiritual experience of your own and getting any higher power that you want. Like, it's so non-denominational or so easy peasy, like, you know, in nature and horses and dogs and cats. Like, I see it everywhere in the rooms, you know, with love. So it has been a really, really fun thing, and I will probably continue to do it. So anyway, thank you for letting me share. Thanks, guys.